In January 1989, California enacted Proposition 99. This was a policy that raised the state cigarette tax by 25 cents per pack.
Right, which was a pretty significant jump at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And over the following decade, per capita cigarette sales in the state just plummeted. I mean, they went from 116 packs a year in 1988 all the way down to 60 packs by the year 2000.
Wow.
Yeah. On paper, that is nearly a 50% drop. So, you know, it sounds like this massive, undeniable policy victory, but there is a pretty significant catch here. The entire country was already quitting smoking.
Exactly. That underlying national trend completely complicates the evaluation. Because during this exact same period, we see rising health awareness, massive shifts in cultural norms about indoor smoking.
Right. You couldn't smoke on airplanes anymore, things like that.
Exactly. And, you know, the accumulation of medical literature. Smoking rates were dropping everywhere, not just in California. So the fundamental empirical puzzle for anyone evaluating Proposition 99 is determining how much of that nearly 50% drop in California was actually caused by the tax versus, you know, how much would have happened organically even if the legislation had never passed.
And that puzzle is exactly why we're here. Welcome to this academic deep dive designed specifically as an audio study guide for you, the economics graduate students listening in.
Glad to be here to walk through this with you all.
Today, our mission is to rigorously examine the methodological implementation and really the interpretation of six different causal inference estimators. We're using a highly instructive replication tutorial developed by the ODSA social data science team. It's titled Policy Evaluation in R6 Estimators for Proposition 99.
And I have to say, it is an invaluable resource for a study guide because it applies six distinct method families to the exact same data set.
Which is rare to see all in one place.
It really is.
Yeah.
By holding the data constant, we are forced to confront the specific mathematical assumptions that each method makes. We get to see firsthand why these estimators diverge, and sometimes they diverge wildly in their conclusion.
Right. But before we dive into the specific code implementation steps and, you know, the models themselves, we need to establish the foundational concept that ties all these methods together, and that is the counterfactual.
Yes, the counterfactual is everything here.
Every causal estimator we're going to discuss today shares a common structural skeleton regarding the average treatment effect on the treated or the ATT.
Right. The calculation of the ATT is remarkably straightforward in theory. You take the treated unit's observed outcome, which in this case is California's actual documented cigarette sales, and you just subtract a constructed counterfactual.
Simple subtraction?
Conceptually, yes. The observed data is fixed. It's a historical record. The entire challenge of causal inference lies entirely in how we construct that second half of the equation.
Because the counterfactual is the unobservable reality. It's,
yeah,
you know, what California's consumption trajectory would have looked like had the tax hike never occurred.
Precisely. It's an alternate universe.
It makes me think of, well, imagine a clinical trial where a researcher just forgets to include a placebo group.
Oh, a nightmare scenario.
Total nightmare. You have a patient who takes a new blood pressure drug and their blood pressure goes down, but you can't definitively prove the drug worked unless you can somehow use their historical medical records or maybe the charts of similar patients to basically reverse engineer what their vitals would have been if they had only swallowed a sugar pill.
That analogy perfectly isolates the problem. We don't have access to parallel universes,
yeah,
so we must rely on statistical architecture to build one. And the easiest trap to fall into is assuming that the subject's own past is the best blueprint for that architecture.
Which leads us directly into our first category of models, right? The within-unit extrapolation.
Right.
So let's start with the most elementary implementation, which is method one, the naive pre-post comparison. If I'm setting this up in R, the steps are incredibly basic. I calculate the mean of California cigarette sales in the years immediately prior to the policy, specifically the window from 1984 to 1988. Then I subtract the mean of the sales from the post-policy period, let's say 1989 to 1993. And when you run that basic arithmetic, the output is a drop of negative 27.02 packs.
Okay, we must pause right here for everyone listening. You have to apply strict estimate discipline here. A drop of the 27 packs is a mathematically accurate description of the data, but the estimate here is purely descriptive.
Right.
It is dangerous to interpret this as a causal effect.
It's because doing so assumes the counterfactual is just a completely flat line.
Precisely. If you claim the tax caused the entire 27-pack drop, your implicit assumption is that without the tax, California's consumption would have remained frozen at its 1988 levels indefinitely.
Which makes no sense given the national context.
None at all. It completely ignores the secular decline happening nationwide. Any organic decrease in smoking is silently absorbed into that negative 27.02 figure, which vastly overstates the policy's success.
Okay, so the assumption of a flat line is empirically false. The obvious next step, logically, is to assume a sloped line instead.
Right.
And this brings us to method 3A, interrupted time series, or ITS, using a linear growth curve. The implementation step here requires fitting a linear regression model purely on California's pre-intervention data from 1970 to 1988. Then you just extrapolate that straight line forward into the post-intervention period up to the year 2000.
And when you fit that linear pre-trend, the slope actually reveals that smoking in California was already declining at a rate of 1.78 packs per year, well before Proposition 99 even hit the ballot.
Okay, so a clear downward trajectory.
Yes. You then calculate the gap between the actual observed sales and this newly extrapolated downward trend line, and the estimated effect comes out to negative 28.28 packs.
Wait, hold on. That is almost identical to the naive flatline approach. I mean, why didn't accounting for the downward trend shrink the estimated effect?
It's a great question. It's because a simple linear trend is far too rigid. The national decline in smoking wasn't a constant velocity. It was actively accelerating in the late 1980s as public health campaigns really gained traction.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, a straight line severely understates that acceleration. So both the naive pre-post and the linear IDES fail fundamentally because they restrict their information environment exclusively to California's past, leaving them completely blind to broader macroeconomic shifts.
Okay, so if a straight line is too rigid to capture that acceleration, then the methodological solution seems to be adding flexibility.
That's the intuition, yes.
Which leads to method 3B. This attempts exactly that by using an auto-selected ARIMA model for the interrupted time series. The tutorial uses an algorithm that tests various time series specifications on the pre-period and selects the best fit based on an information criterion, specifically the AICC.
Right, the corrected AKK information criteria.
Exactly. So the algorithm lands on an ARIMA 120 model. But the output here is genuinely alarming. The estimated ATT is positive 4.55 packs.
Let's consider the economic implication of that output for a second. A positive AKT suggests that raising the price of a good by 25 cents per unit actually caused consumption to increase.
Which violates the basic law of demand.
Completely. It highlights a critical vulnerability in relying on automated time series forecasting for policy evaluation.
Yeah, I look at the reliance on purely in-sample fit metrics like the AICC, and it just feels highly problematic for causal work. I mean, it penalizes complexity to prevent overfitting the past, but it doesn't guarantee the model actually understands the underlying structural reality.
Not at all.
It feels akin to tracking a sudden drop in barometric pressure over 3 days, plugging it into an autoregressive algorithm, and basically predicting that the atmosphere will completely evaporate by next Tuesday.
That atmospheric analogy is completely appropriate.
Right.
Because it highlights the danger of momentum. The fatal flaw here is explicitly embedded in the middle parameter of that ARIMA specification, the 2 in ARIMA 120.
The integration order.
Yes. That integer indicates double differencing. In time series mechanics, while single differencing models velocity, double differencing models acceleration.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The algorithm perfectly memorized the sharp downward acceleration of California's sales in the late 1980s.
So it assumed the floor was going to drop out entirely.
Yes. The model aggressively extrapolated that late 1980s momentum. It's constructed counterfactual, predicted that California sales would organically plummet to around 50 packs by the year 2000 without any tax intervention whatsoever.
That's incredibly steep.
It is. And because the actual observed sales only dropped to 60 packs, the model technically records that the policy resulted in 10 more packs, or rather, a net of about 5 more packs on average sold than expected. It is a textbook demonstration of why letting an algorithm optimize purely for in-sample fit can yield completely disastrous out-of-sample counterfactuals.
So relying on the treated unit's own past is basically a dead end. Whether you use a rigid line or a highly flexible autoregressive curve, it just doesn't work here.
It just doesn't hold up.
This forces a transition in our strategy. We really must introduce outside information. So let's look at method 2. Difference in differences, or DIDI, against a single control unit. The implementation steps are quite simple. We select a neighboring state, let's use Nevada, we calculate Nevada's pre-to-post change in average sales, and we just subtract that figure from California's pre-to-post change.
Right. And the underlying theory here is that Nevada serves as a proxy for the secular trend. Whatever macro forces affected Nevada theoretically should have affected California similarly.
Makes intuitive sense.
It does. However, the resulting ATT estimate from this is negative 5.68 PACs, and the standard errors indicate it is statistically indistinguishable from zero. The effect entirely collapses.
So why does simply looking at a neighboring state fail to produce a significant result? I mean, they're right next to each other.
The mechanism of difference in differences relies on a very strict assumption: parallel trends. The treated unit and the control unit must evolve on parallel paths in the absence of the intervention. But Nevada experienced its own independent massive reduction in smoking during this window, a drop of over 21 PACs.
Ah, because Nevada is geographically, culturally, and economically intertwined with California.
Exactly.
It was likely exposed to similar retail pricing spillovers, you know, federal tobacco litigation, and shared media markets broadcasting those exact same health campaigns.
Yep, the spillovers are massive.
This implies that standard ditty is incredibly fragile when you anchor your entire counterfactual to a single control unit. If that one unit experiences a localized shock, your entire estimate is compromised.
It is a very precarious way to model a counterfactual. But before we address how to build a better control group, we should examine one final method that attempts to isolate the policy effect using time, but through structural breaks rather than simple extrapolation.
Right. Method 4.
Yes. Regression discontinuity design, or RDD, deployed on time.
So for the implementation steps here, we treat calendar time as the continuous running variable. The threshold is the exact enactment date of Proposition 99 in 1989. The tutorial fits a piecewise linear regression, also known as a segmented regression, which is specified to allow for two things. First, an immediate level jump at the threshold, and second, a change in the slope following at the threshold.
And when you examine the output coefficients of this segmented model, they present a really compelling narrative. The model detects an immediate sharp level drop of negative 20.06 PACs exactly at the 1989 intervention date.
That's a huge immediate drop.
It is. And additionally, it identifies a slope change, basically an acceleration in the decline, amounting to an extra 1.49 fewer PACs per year. When you project that compounding slope change forward, the cumulative deviation reaches roughly negative 36 PACs by the end of the decade.
I mean, mathematically, that looks like a robust finding. It isolates the discontinuity precisely when the policy goes into effect.
It is mathematically elegant, I'll give it that. But it's causally vulnerable. Think critically about the identification assumption here. RDD on time assumes that no other relevant structural shifts occurred precisely at that threshold.
Right.
But consider the historical context. In 1988, the U.S. Surgeon General released a landmark report officially classifying nicotine as a highly addictive substance, which totally shifted the national discourse.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. If that report caused a nationwide curvature in smoking habits starting right around 1988, this piecewise regression misattributes that entire national behavioral shift purely to California's state tax, simply because the dates closely align.
Because the algorithm is programmed to only look for a break at the threshold, so it just attributes everything that happens at that moment to the running variables cutoff.
Exactly.
Okay, so single controls are too noisy, past extrapolations are either too rigid or too sensitive to momentum, and time-based structural breaks are easily confounded by simultaneous historical events.
You got it.
Which brings us to the core of the modern causal consensus. Method 5 is synthetic control. This really seems to be the discipline's principled response to the fragility of relying on a single state like Nevada.
The theoretical intuition is brilliant. If no single state in the union provides a reliable parallel counterfactual for California, perhaps a mathematical amalgamation of multiple states can accurately synthesize one.
Right. And the tutorial implements this using the TidySynth package in R. The steps involve defining a donor pool, which consists of the 38 other available states in the dataset.
Right, excluding states that had their own massive tax hikes.
Exactly. So the algorithm's objective is to calculate a set of convex weights, meaning they must be non-negative, and sum to one to minimize the root mean squared prediction error, or RMSPE, during the pre-1988 period. To do this, it attempts to match California on a specific set of predictors.
And what are those predictors?
We have behavioral covariates like per capita income, retail price of cigarettes, the youth age structure, and even per capita beer consumption. We also feed it lagged outcomes, specifically the actual cigarette sales recorded in 1975, 1980, and 1988.
That optimization process is really the engine of the method. The algorithm is basically iterating through thousands of weight combinations to create a recipe for a phantom state, a synthetic California, that behaves statistically identically to the real California in the years before the tax.
What I found striking, though, when looking at the implementation outputs are the internal weight matrices.
Oh, this is the fascinating part.
Yeah.
Right. First, you have the W matrix, which dictates the state weights. Out of 38 available donor states, only 5 receive any meaningful weight. Utah gets 34%, Nevada 24%, Montana 18%, Colorado 18%, and Connecticut 6%.
So highly concentrated.
Very. The remaining 33 states are effectively assigned a weight of 0. Then, looking at the V matrix, which dictates the predictor weights, the algorithm assigns 88.5% of the importance solely to the lagged outcome variables. It almost completely ignores covariates like beer consumption or the youth age structure.
This is a vital observation for anyone utilizing synthetic control algorithms. By assigning nearly 90% of the predictor weight to lagged outcomes, the algorithm has determined that the absolute best predictor of California's past smoking behavior is, well, simply California's past smoking behavior.
See, it makes sense when you put it like that.
It heavily anchors the optimization on prior outcome levels. This forces the synthetic unit's trajectory to trace California's pre-1988 trajectory with incredible precision. And the result from this highly optimized synthetic blend is an estimated ATT of negative 18.72 packs per capita.
The precision is impressive, but it raises a fundamental statistical question for me. In standard regression, we rely on standard errors to determine significance. But with synthetic control, we only have one treated unit and a custom-built counterfactual. You can't just run traditional frequentist standard errors on this, right?
Correct. You absolutely cannot. Standard frequentist inference assumes repeated sampling from a population, which just does not apply to a single observed macro-level policy event like a state tax. Instead, inference in synthetic control relies on permutation tests, which are often called in-space placebos.
Okay, let's break down those implementation steps for the students listening. To generate a p-value without standard errors, the tutorial runs a placebo test. You refit the exact same TidySynth optimization pipeline, but you iteratively pretend that each of the 38 donor states in the pool was the one that actually received Proposition 99.
Right. You build a synthetic Utah, a synthetic Colorado, a synthetic Montana, and so forth. And for every single state, you calculate the mean squared prediction error ratio.
Which is what exactly?
This is the error in the post-treatment period divided by the error in the pre-treatment period. If Proposition 99 genuinely altered behavior in California, then California's post-period divergence from its synthetic counterpart should be an extreme outlier compared to all the placebo states that had no such tax.
And the data confirms this perfectly. When you rank the MSPE ratios, California ranks first out of all 39 units. Its ratio is approximately 120, which is nearly 3 times higher than the second place placebo state.
That's a massive gap.
Yeah. And because it ranks 1 out of 39 permutations, dividing 1 by 39 yields a Fisher exact p-value of roughly 0.026. In plain terms, the mathematical probability of a divergence this extreme happening by random chance is less than 3%.
Which provides rigorous, defensible confidence that the negative 18.72 pack effect is a genuine causal impact rather than just an artifact of natural variance within the donor pool.
That permutation framework is really elegant. But what if we want to approach the structural modeling from an entirely different philosophical paradigm?
Moving from frequentist to Bayesian.
Exactly. This leads us to our final estimator, method 6, causal impact, which utilizes Bayesian structural modeling.
Causal impact is an open source package originally developed by researchers at Google. While synthetic control restricts its donor pool weights to be convex, meaning summing to one causal impact, utilizes a Bayesian structural time series, or BSTS model.
The implementation of the BSTS model involves fitting a mathematical formula with 2 distinct components on the pre-period data. The first component is a local-level trend designed to absorb unobserved baseline dynamics that no combination of external control series could explain.
Right.
The second component is a linear combination of the donor state series acting as predictors.
Crucially, though, the tutorial highlights an important data preparation step here that we can't gloss over. Time series algorithms demand continuous data, but the Odyssey dataset contains missing values in several covariates.
Real-world data is always messy.
Always. The authors handle this by implementing random forest multiple imputation prior to model fitting. Random forest can handle nonlinear relationships and interactions among variables to accurately estimate those missing gaps in the matrix without distorting the underlying variance.
That's a neat trick. So once the data is imputed and the Bayesian model is run, it outputs an average ATT of negative 13 packs per capita. Over the 12-year evaluation window, that translates to a cumulative effect of negative 154 packs.
A very substantial drop.
But the output format is entirely different from the synthetic control permutation. Instead of a p-value, the software provides a Bayesian posterior credible interval. How should a graduate student interpret a credible interval compared to a traditional frequentist confidence interval?
The distinction is paramount for methodological clarity. A standard frequentist 95% confidence interval is a statement about the sampling procedure itself over infinite theoretical repetitions. It does not actually tell you the probability that the true effect is within that specific numerical range.
Right, which always trips people up.
It really does. But causal impacts output, a 95% posterior credible interval, spanning from negative 32 to positive 5.7, is a direct probability statement. It asserts that, given the specific observed data and the structural prior embedded in the model, there is exactly a 95% probability that the true causal parameter lies within that boundary.
So it maps much more closely to how we intuitively process risk and probability in reality.
Yes, exactly. And we can interrogate that posterior distribution further. The model calculates that there is a 92% posterior probability of a causal effect existing at all.
Okay, so we have now walked through the implementation of six distinct estimators. As a study guide, we need to synthesize this into section six, triangulation and estimand discipline. When we compare the outputs side by side, the results seem to naturally aggregate into three distinct clusters.
It's an excellent way to conceptualize the literature. The variance across these clusters is deeply instructive. I like to think of these statistical estimators as different architects hired to calculate the precise height of a commercial building that has already been demolished.
I love this analogy. The first cluster is what we could call the overshoots. These are the models that solely rely on extrapolating California's past the naive pre-posts and the linear ITs. They both output an effect of around negative 28 packs.
Right.
In our architectural analogy, these are the architects who merely examine the concrete foundation and assume the walls continued straight up forever, completely ignoring the zoning laws that restricted height across the entire city. They absorb the secular decline and massively overstate the policy impact.
Exactly. The second cluster comprises the broken outliers. We have the failed single control differences at negative 5.7 and the highly volatile auto-selected ARIMA model at positive 4.5.
The ones that really went off the rails.
Yep. These are the architects who either blindly point to a neighboring building and assume identical dimensions regardless of context, or who overanalyze the curvature of a single surviving steel beam and project it into an impossible geometry.
And the final cluster is the causal consensus. Synthetic control, Bayesian causal impact, and the time-based RDD all converge tightly in the range of negative 13 to negative 20 packs.
The robust models.
This is the architect who systematically blends the structural dimensions of the entire surrounding neighborhood, utilizing an optimization algorithm to mathematically reconstruct the missing blueprint.
Which brings us to the core thesis of estimand discipline. The underlying data set, every cigarette sold, every demographic variable recorded, is absolutely identical across all six models.
Right. The data never changed.
Exactly. The divergence in the final numerical estimates is entirely the price of the underlying assumption each mathematical formula makes regarding the construction of the unobservable counterfactual.
For a policymaker or, you know, a graduate student writing a dissertation, the practical takeaway is that relying on a single specification is indefensible. Through methodological triangulation, you can confidently conclude that Proposition 99 resulted in an average reduction of roughly 18 packs per capita per year, or a cumulative reduction of 150 to 250 fewer packs over the decade.
Yes. You can defend that specific range precisely because it survives multiple causally defensible specifications.
It requires the discipline of understanding not really how to execute the code, but understanding exactly what that code assumes about the economic realities of the world.
As we conclude this deep dive into the Odyssey dataset, I want to leave you with a provocative thought exercise drawn directly from the text's advanced study questions.
Oh, this is a good one.
What if you conducted an in-time placebo test? Imagine artificially setting the date of the Proposition 99 tax intervention to 1985 instead of 1989.
A fake policy date.
Right. If you refit your entire synthetic control optimization pipeline to that fake 1985 date, and you still observe a massive gap opening up between California and the synthetic unit before the real tax even passed, what fatal flaw does that reveal about your identification strategy?
A terrifying thought for any researcher.
And more importantly, how could you systematically utilize placebo tests like that to identify unobserved confounding variables and bulletproof your own economic research? The formulas in an econometrics textbook are pristine, but observational data is profoundly messy. As researchers, your task is to construct the counterfactual that can survive the mess.